I'm very happy now to welcome Christian Kiefer. He's the author of two novels, The Infinite Tides, and his new book just released last month, The Animals. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book, it's kind of a, I don't know if you call it this, but to me it's kind of a literary thriller. It's gripping, it's beautifully written. The main human character is this man who runs a wildlife sanctuary in northern Idaho. And I was wondering, and he's a man whose past comes back to haunt him at a certain point in his life and in the book. And I was wondering if this setting, the world of wild animals and animal rescue, was the starting point for the story.
It wasn't, actually. I did a bunch of failed drafts of this book in trying to make the themes and ideas and the characters come together in a way that satisfied me. And I happened to visit a wildlife rescue north of Reno when I was doing research on Reno. And when I walked into that place, it's called Animal Ark, and when I walked into Animal Ark, I thought immediately, oh, this is where my character would want to work. And then I thought, oh no, like this is where my character would work later to try to redeem himself, to try to change himself. And to me, that's the core question of the book is, can you change the core thing that is who you are, your basic core self? Can that be altered and changed? Can you become a better person?
I think it's so interesting when people write about animals and animals in some way become part of the drama, because animals in some fundamental way don't change. They're born the way they are, they live out their lives, and they die. And this question of whether human beings really can change or not is some way rooted in that question of how similar or different we are from animals.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I'm not sure, you know, I don't think that core thing inside of us can change, really. I think human beings differ from animals, and of course we use animals in the most philosophic way possible, but I think one of the ways we differ is we have a lot of layers over that core thing, and we have a sense, particularly in the West, that our personalities are something that can be worked on and improved. You know, walk into any bookstore and look at the small fiction section and the vast self-help section,
right?
And that's evidence of that, right? But, you know, my protagonist, and I will say also the protagonists of books like Les Miserables and Thomas Hardy's Mayor of Casterbridge and Conrad's Lord Jim, I mean, these are all characters who want a clean start, and they want to be different. They want to be better. They at least want to adjust into a new circumstance. And, you know, like our animal friends, we are, I think, essentially pre-programmed from the start. I think a lot of us with children, a lot of parents can sort of recognize this, like our children are essentially who they are from a very early age, and the best we can do as parents is try to strap some ethics and morality over the top of that, you know?
Right.
And I think that's where these characters are, too, in the course of the novel.
The drama that unfolds in the book is about people who live on the kind of the margins of society. Reno, Nevada is kind of almost a character in the book as well. And these people, I mean, you know, there was love, but there was also abuse and addiction and kind of a lack of hope for anything better. And one of the things I found so interesting was the way you describe, in a very visceral way, gambling addiction. And there's this sense that the character, when he's gambling, he feels like he's in control, even though he knows he's not. And I wonder how you put yourself into that mind without presumably becoming a gambling addict.
Yeah, well, you want to take your research far, but maybe not that far, right? Yeah, I mean, one of the questions of the book is do we really have free will? And philosophers like Daniel Dennett and Hofstadter and others have postulated that if you make a concrete decision, you know, today you decided to get a cup of coffee, something very simple. If you went back in time, given the information and the situation being the same, you would get a cup of coffee again. And if you did that a million times and went back to that moment, every time you'd get a cup of coffee. So then the philosophic question is, do you have any free will at all? And the gambling thing in the book is really, to me, in part about that. Addicts teeter on this interesting knife edge of, are we in control or are we not in control? You know, and when my protagonist is winning, he feels like he's in control. When he's losing, he feels like he's out of control. But in fact, he's really out of control the entire time. You know, luck is the great bugaboo of all the casino culture, right? It's this great myth that luck is either with you or it's not. You know, I'm feeling lucky today. But that's just a way to kind of grab hold of that electric cable that will inform your ability to exercise your free will in a way that has depth and meaning for you. You know, as a writer, I feel very strongly that I'm compelled to do this work. So sometimes my students ask me, like, you know, how do you keep going? You know, how do you keep writing? And to me, it's not a choice. It's a compulsion. Like, I have to go into that room and sit down, and I have to type. And I do that every day. And, you know, my wife and my family understand it. Like, oh, daddy's going to go do his work now. And sometimes it's for an hour, and sometimes it's for 12 hours. It just really depends on how heavy the spark is coming that day. So that is the way I kind of access that notion of gambling in the text. You know, I'm not an addict in any concrete way that we have a category for. I certainly know addicts, and I know recovered addicts, many of them actually. And I talked to many of them, and I got a sense of what that means. And the best I can do as a writer is try to yoke it into some experience that I've had in order to give it life and depth and empathy. And so that's how I did it for this book.
This book is such a great story, and it's so beautifully told. And, you know, as we're sort of alluding to, and we don't want to give the book away because I hope a lot of people read it, but, you know, it's a guy who's left a pretty awful past behind, and then it comes back to haunt him when somebody gets out of prison. And my experience as a reader of reading this book, it was kind of like I'm looking at a dark screen, and then an image appears. And then another part of the screen, another image appears, and you start to piece together the entire picture slowly. It's not chronological until there are like a few dark spaces left that you want to see, but you also dread finding out what's there. And it's so interesting because you make it suspenseful, even though we already know what's coming. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that craft, about how you put the story together in that way.
Yeah, well, first, I'm so pleased to hear you say that. It's just completely gratifying to me that the book pulled you in that way. And that's exactly, I mean, your description of it is exactly what I want people to feel when they're reading the book. You know, my first book spins in one place, and it purposefully has very little forward momentum. I was really interested in kind of a Henry James or Joycean kind of treatment of time and of character. And for this book, I really wanted it to have some forward momentum. So, and I tried to do that from the first chapter, from the first page even. And part of the way to do that for me was to obfuscate the past a bit. So it's told in alternating chapters. The first chapter takes place in 1996 in North Idaho. And the second chapter takes place in 1984 in Reno, Nevada. And the chapters flip-flop that way. And the 1984 chapters give you the backstory. And in part, I did that in order to make the backstory necessary, because oftentimes kind of my eyes sort of glaze over when I'm watching a TV show or something, and they fuzzy focus and take us back into the character's past. And almost never do you need that information. It's like, just keep us in the present. Like, we get what's happening. Everything's great, you know. So I tried, nonetheless, to give you some past and tried to give it to you in pieces so that the whole thing came together. You know, you're building two separate puzzles, and at the end they kind of lock together, I hope. You know, that's essentially the structural method. And then there's a third stream of time in the book, which is often in the 70s and or in the gap between the 80s and the 90s. And those sections are told in present tense, second person. And that point of view switch was largely made in order to give those sections some velocity because of the same sense of fear that I had that I would just lose the reader by going back and forth too many times.
It was interesting to encounter the second person, because for me, when I read something that's in the second person, I sometimes think that the way that it's used is almost like the person is not quite present, like they're seeing themselves from the outside in some way. And I wondered if you were, like, what does the second person do for you, for the narrative?
Well, part of the conceit of the book is the protagonist talks to himself a lot.
Yeah.
So there are little moments of second person throughout the book, which is meant to be the protagonist just having an ongoing monologue with himself, or dialogue even with himself. You know, there's no quote marks in the book, so all the dialogue is unquoted. And part of that was to blur the line between, is he saying the stuff out loud? Is he saying the stuff in his head? And it's not excessive, but they're just little moments of that.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. When we get those second person present tense sections in the 70s and then later in the 80s and early 90s, they are meant really to be him telling himself the story of himself, in a sense. And it's also meant to drag you along with it. It's funny, a lot of readers have commented on that second person stuff, which to me, you know, at the time of writing it, it just seemed really natural. It didn't seem like much of a risk, but readers are really excited or freaked out or put off or titillated by the second person. I'm just stealing something that Pam Houston does expertly, and that's where I learned how to do that from reading her work. To me, it's, you know, in some ways it's almost an homage to what she does so well.
It's funny that you say he talks to himself a lot, because he also talks to the bear in the sanctuary a lot.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I mean, you know, the book is so rich with, I loved it for so many reasons, but one of them is it's so rich with philosophical themes that you could talk about all night, and yet it never loses that sense of a story moving along. It doesn't stop you and wax eloquent about anything like that, but you do it yourself in your head as a reader. And so, okay, so there's these themes of animals. Animals are caged. Should injured animals be allowed to die? Should they be put into cages and kept in captivity? And meanwhile, there's the kind of antagonist in the book was also caged. He was in jail. And there are these deep relationships that, especially the protagonist, evolves over time with his animals, with this bear that he talks to. And I was wondering how you got yourself, I mean, you got yourself into Gambling Mind. You got yourself, it seems to me, very deeply into animal mind, animal cognition.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, I'm smiling hugely right now because of your kindness in responding to the book the way you have, which is just so wonderful to hear. You know, the grizzly bit with the protagonist takes care of a grizzly who's old and blind, and the grizzly's named Major, and Major's really his best friend. And I work pretty hard to figure out what to do with Major and how to write about the animals in a way that was not anthropomorphizing or any other kind of misstep. You know, the risk is, on the one hand, you turn it into Air Bud, the movie about the dog that plays basketball, or you do a Richard Adams Watership Down thing, which is in its way wonderful, but that's also not what I wanted to do. I spent the summer, when I was heavy drafting this book, reading Heidegger to try to understand from a philosophical point of view what the self is or what being is. And that's a great way to ruin your summer. If anyone ever wants to ruin their summer, reading Heidegger all summer is the way to do it. It's the opposite of beach reading. Somewhere along the line of reading Heidegger, I came upon this Estonian-born German theoretical biologist named Jakob von Uexküll, a contemporary of Heidegger's. And Uexküll has this notion that he calls Umwelt, which in German just means environment. But Uexküll means it, in a sense, to talk about a bubble of world that exists around all living things individually. So you have a bubble of world around you, Mary Charlotte, and I have a bubble of world around me, and they're different. So as when we enter a particular environment, let's say we go out to a nightclub together, and wouldn't that be fun? And my bubble of world, you know, let's say I'm a recovering alcoholic. Well, my bubble of world is like, okay, I got to keep it together. I can't have a drink. I got to make sure, like, you know, this is not the environment I want to be in. And yours might be much more casual, right? Because our bubbles of world are different. Well, this is true in the animal world, too. So what that helped me do is conceptualize the grizzly's life in a way that made sense to me as a writer. Okay, what is a grizzly's bubble of world? How does that bubble of world look to a grizzly, and especially a grizzly in a cage, which has a very, you know, his bubble of world is limited by the bars. Grizzlies also have a very keen sense of smell. It's their primary sense in dealing with the world. So part of my understanding was attempting to write from a grizzly's point of view via its sense of smell rather than its sense of sight, which is how most fiction is. It's a feast of sight and of sound with a dialogue and not much else, right? I mean, there aren't many books that I can think of that have a strong sense of smell. So a lot of it was that, and I knew early on that I wanted to try to write a chapter of the book directly from the point of view of the bear. And then I had 6 months of anxiety trying to figure out how to do that, and I read just about everything I think you can find to read about grizzlies, Doug Peacock and Pastoureau, and just tons of stuff on bears and animal cognition and animal consciousness, and did the best I could with that section. I still think today that chapter from the point of view of the bear is the best writing I've done, and maybe the best writing I'll ever do.
I was actually going to ask you to read from the book, and that chapter did come to mind, but any part that you would like to read would be wonderful.
So this is from the chapter that starts zeroing in on the bear, and it's going to be a little bit abstract to the listener because it takes place on page 263 after a lot of stuff has gone down. But this is how it sounds. At the end, the bear finds himself. I'm sorry. Let me start over. At the end, the bear finds himself looking down at a vast sagebrush plain lit only by starlight and ringed by dry, colorless mountains gone the color of black night. The two men stand at the edge of a collection of battered buildings and trailers that huddled in the middle of that darkness. Around them is a bleak town of some sort, and the bear knows this even though he does not know what a town is, has never seen one, and yet knows more now than he ever has in his life, here at the end. Although he does not know where he is or how he has come to such a place. There are questions, but the bear does not ask them. The time for questions has long passed. One of the figures below him is the man he knows, the man the bear might call friend if he knew such a concept. Maybe he does, but what the bear wonders at now is the man's smell, for it seems to come to him across time and across the darkness. He can smell him across all his life, and the sense of him there makes the bear call out in a long, protracted moan. How much he misses the man in that moment, and how much he knows that he will never see him again.
Christian Kiefer reading from his book, The Animals. Now, you are also an accomplished musician. You've made bunches of albums, and you've got a soundtrack album that goes with this book, which we're going to hear a little bit of when we wrap up. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you feel like your work as a musician perhaps affects your writing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you know, the interesting thing about this is for many, many years, I maintained that my writing and my music and the other creative work I do was all kind of a piece. It was all coming from the same vat. But I have found, more accurately, when I'm writing a novel, I have no creative juice left for anything else. So when I'm deep in a novel, like, I don't touch an instrument sometimes for a year. There is, however, a sense of structure and structurelessness in the kind of music that I make. On the one hand, I write songs. On the other hand, I make kind of droney, avant-garde, soundtrack-like music. And I think all writing, for me, kind of flips between those two states of being. Sometimes it's very structured, like this particular book has a lot of very concrete kind of structure, but there are sort of flights of writerly fancy that I do in the book too, which is more akin to the kind of soundtrack-like music that I make sometimes, and the soundtrack-like music that is, in fact, the soundtrack to the book. I listen to music constantly when I write. I always listen to music when I write. It never has lyrics. It most often has very little structure, and it can't be very complicated. Like, I can't write while listening to Bach or Coltrane or something like that. It's got to be a little looser, a little quieter, a little less apt to draw attention to itself. So the texture of that kind of music, the tonal range of that kind of music is I think woven through this book all the way through to the end. And what I tried to do with the soundtrack is I tried to make something that would capture that texture or that tonal range. So there's a digital version of it on iTunes and whatnot, but there's also a vinyl version that was put together by Jealous Butcher Records up in Portland. And the vinyl version, Side A is North Nevada, and Side B is North Idaho. So
nice.
Depending on what chapter you read, you can drop the needle on the Nevada side, or you can drop the needle on the Idaho side.
So you would like people to perhaps be listening to the soundtrack as they're reading the book?
I mean, I think that would be pretty fun. I don't know. I mean, it's the perfect, like it was like when I had the music, when the music was coming together, I was still doing the final edits of the book. And I listened to it a lot, actually, when I was doing those edits, because
yeah.
It was, you know, I kind of tried to make exactly the music that I would want to listen to while writing the book. So I think it would be an interesting experiment to listen to it while reading. Pop on your headphones at Starbucks and go through a chapter.
Or your local independent coffee shop,
as
I'm sitting in one right now here in Santa Fe.
That's a much, much better answer.
I wondered, you went through, I read or heard somewhere, a lot of drafts of writing to complete this book. And
yeah.
why so many revisions? I mean, what was going on there?
Well, my method is terrible. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, I do 40 drafts of books. This is what I found. I did 41 of the first one. I did like 38 or 9 of this one. But it's just my method. I can't, you know, I do outline, you know, I know where the book is going, but I'm obsessive about two things. I'm obsessive about the words, the actual words, and I'm also obsessive about the flow of the sentences, the rhythm of the sentences. So every one of those drafts I read out loud to myself and with a pen on paper made the edits. And a lot of it was the rhythm of the sentences or finding the right words or figuring out where I could really make the language bloom. Dialing in the dialogue a little bit better, that kind of thing, is easy. Attending to the poetry of the language takes me many, many drafts. And I think it was Hemingway who said that he was a mediocre writer, but he was an excellent rewriter. And I think that's more or less where I stand on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a ridiculous process. I mean, there's plenty of writers who say, like, oh, this one was hard. Like, I had to do 4 drafts of this one to get it right. And I'm like, 4 drafts? Like, holy cow. You don't want to read my 4th draft. It's terrible.
Yeah, know? it's so hard to believe. I mean, I believe you, but it's kind of hard to believe given that the book flows the way it does. But I've heard lots of writers say that, like their first draft and their second draft are truly awful.
Well, I have 10 drafts of this book that are completely a different book because at some point I essentially threw the draft out. I kept the ending scene and I wrote an entirely new book to get back to that ending scene because the ending scene is the part that I couldn't drop. And then I have several drafts in the middle where Nat's problems, the protagonist in the Reno section, Nat's problems are Rick's problems. In other words, their problems are flip-flopped. And at some point during the drafting process, I knew there was a big problem in the book, and I suddenly realized, oh, the problem is I have them flipped. I need to change their problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to rewrite all of the Reno section of the book, which is half the book, and I had to rewrite it essentially from scratch to make it all work. But yeah, I mean, I tell that to my peers and my friends, you know, and I mean, they understand it now, but I mean, it's ludicrous because, you know, like get it right the first couple of times, you know, and you don't have to do these things. But that's my process.
Yeah, but I mean, if that's how it works, that's how it works. I mean, one of the things, yeah, there's the rhythm of the sentences and choosing the right words, but there's also something that I found is a really important part of the book because you don't use quotations around the dialogue, but there's a lot of dialogue, and part of what you have to do is really capture the speech patterns of these people. And I'm always amazed by the fact that middle-class people who grew up and went to college and got advanced degrees and stuff like that, can really speak the speech patterns of criminals and lowlifes.
Yeah.
Where do you go for that?
Well, you know, growing up, my mom was a waitress, my dad was a mechanic, and he was like a stock car racer at the fairgrounds dirt track, you know, so all of his friends were stock car racers. And, you know, part of it is just that. I mean, I grew up in a town of maybe 6,000 people, and I live now in a town of 500. That's part of it. And then I also teach students at a public community college in Sacramento, and my students are by and large united by being broke.
Yeah.
So some of it is that, and then porting that back in time to 1984 by way of watching all the movies, you know, that came out around that time about young people, from Breakfast Club to Red Dawn to Empire Strikes Back, you know, to try to get a sense of speech patterns and remind myself what it was like to talk and be young in the 80s, which is when I grew up. These characters are a little older than me, but not by much. So this apple hasn't fallen that far from the tree, to use a bad cliche.
So you teach writing, and I wondered, when you've got all these students who want to have a career as fiction writers, what do you tell them? Like, how do you nurture them and also give them a sense of reality?
I just punch them. I just punch them right in the nose and say, that's how it feels.
What do you mean?
It's such an impossible career. You have to have such an enormous well I'm not going to say talent, because I don't actually like that word, but you have to have a particular way of seeing the world and a particular relationship with language. I think if you're not a huge reader, a huge reader, you're probably not particularly well suited to this. And in the same way that if you're not obsessed with computers, like, do not choose to be a computer programmer,
right?
To me, it's the same kind of thing. So a lot of my work as a teacher of writing is convincing my students to read, because my students tend to be pretty literate in television and much less literate in actual text. So part of it is that. Part of it is modeling being a writer. My undergraduate teacher when I was 19 and 20 was T.C. Boyle at University of Southern California.
Yeah.
And Boyle modeled being a writer in that, while we were in his class, If the River Was Whiskey came out in paperback, Road to Wilkville came out in hardcover. About a year later, East is East came out in hardcover, and the cover for Tortilla Curtain was on his door, you know, the book that was coming. And then he was on Letterman, he had stories in Paris Review, you know, like he was out there doing the work. So a good part of what I do in teaching writing is just modeling being a writer. So I post my word count of my new novel on Twitter, so people can see, so my students in particular can see, like, that I'm in that chair every day cranking out words. And sometimes the word count is dropping because I'm going through the manuscript cutting things out. And sometimes it's rising, and sometimes it drops precipitously and then rises back up again. And it's just meant to suggest to them, like, being a writer means putting your butt in the chair and writing. And that's it. You know, it's like, how do I be a writer? Write.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, write and write and write. And really, be prepared to fail. Like, I wrote 4 novels that were bad. And then finally, at the age of 40, I finally published my first book, because finally it was good enough to publish. And now I feel like I have some handle on it. And now at 43, I feel like I've lived some life and I have something to say about that life, which I didn't have that at 20. And plenty of writers do have that at 20. I just wasn't one of them. I had to stew a little bit, I'm sort of a late bloomer in the sense of William Gay and other great writers who just, you know, spent a long time living life and then finally came into their own much later. And I'm happy to have survived long enough to get to this point.
Did you know when you wrote these novels that didn't make the grade? I mean, did you know that they didn't cut it, or did you, like, submit them and get that feedback?
I knew the first two weren't cutting it. No, that might not be true. I think the second one I did send out a bunch. It was 750 pages or something, and literally nothing happens in it at all. It was just like an exercise in stasis. And the third one, I did know that it didn't work. And then I stopped for a long time and just made records because I happened to land an independent record deal. And I just thought, okay, like I thought I was going to be a writer, but I can be a musician and I'll just do that because I was doing them both concurrently anyway. And so I just veered into that and spent a lot of years pouring my artistic obsessiveness into that field instead of writing. I was still writing on the side, and I wrote a lot of poetry during that period and published it here and there, but it took me a while to get back to it. A friend, Michael Spurgeon, is a novelist, and he was working on his first novel when I met him, which was maybe 5 years ago, and that kind of sparked me to get back into that because that enabled me to talk about writing again with somebody and to re-enter that intellectual world, and it certainly is an intellectual world. And at the time, I really needed a friend to grab hold of me and pull me back into the flow of words.
Very interesting. So what's next for you? You're coming to Santa Fe. You are touring with this book. Do you have another book in mind? Are you going to do music for a while?
I do have another book, and I'm two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the writing process of that, and I'm redrafting it as I go. And that is about, it's a little bit of a departure for me. It's about cartographers in the early 19th century in southern Germany working under the flag of Napoleon. It's tethered to historical reality, and it's also uncoupled from that reality in the sense that there's a Borges or Calvino or Kafka even sort of level to it where there's a level of unreality, almost a fairy tale reality, unreality that's kind of floating above the narrative the entire time. And as a sort of a straight white male American narrative novelist who writes about that subject, this is really a departure to try to step into the kind of thing that David Mitchell and Neil Gaiman and, you know, great writers like that are working on and can work on with apparent ease. To me, I'm just, you know, I'm always trying to push out to the next thing and try to challenge myself and try to see what I can do. And we'll see how it works. So far, I like what I'm doing, but when I like it and when somebody else likes it, that's sometimes two different things.
We're going to go out with some music right now, which is the soundtrack to your novel, The Animals. Are we going to listen to Reno or Idaho?
Yeah, we'll listen to Nevada Boys, which is in some ways the most narrative, for lack of a better term, pieces of music on the soundtrack album in that it has structure and rhythm and drums and it has kind of a melodic intent. It's a good way to fly off into the Santa Fe morning.
Christian Kiefer's new book is The Animals, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night, Wednesday, the 22nd of April at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very pleased to be coming to Santa Fe.